We've been speaking about some of the things connected with the next world, this world and the next world. And right here we have been looking at the list of things that the Rambam quotes which are so damaging to a person if one does them that one may lose one's share in the next world altogether. Of course, especially for those who are new, this assumes that you understand that there is this world and the next world. I mean, that's axiomatic. The bad news about how damaging these things are, I always try and say something in the beginning that's less frightening than what the Rambam says. The sad news about these things that can cause a person to lose his share in the next world has to be seen in the context of the fact that everybody does have a share in the next world. Life would be unbearable if it weren't for that knowledge. Actually, all pain and all fear is really connected with the death experience. You actually wouldn't have any fear, a mother's anxiety for a child. All emotions of fear, really, stem from the fact that there's a possibility that things may end. So a person understands that this is just the beginning of a system which continues in another phase, that's already a very big comfort for people to know. We're in the very, very bad time of Jewish history where everybody's suffering badly. Families going through suffering. Almost everybody knows somebody, at least if it isn't them, themselves, where there are major problems. And the first thing that you have to know is that this is just an entry into the next world. We know that people who don't have parents, people whose parents are not alive anymore, so the concept is that the only life that the parents have left is what you do. That's why we're not sentimental that Jews dedicate things to the memory of parents, or we do things on a yahrzeit, or we donate things to yeshiva, whatever. It's not just sentimental in memory. We don't have anything that commemorates. We don't have that kind of thing. We don't have anniversaries or commemorations. We only have active living. So when we do something for the neshama of somebody who's not alive, what we're actually doing is giving them life. That the way it works is that you're an extension of their life. You as a child are an extension. You're all that's left in the world of that person's neshama. You are an incarnation of part of their neshama. And therefore what you do in the world by virtue of the fact that you're here because you're their child, and especially if you do things because they taught you those things, you then give them life. Their agony in the next world is the fact that they can't do anything. Now they understand what they should be doing, but they can't do it. They don't have a body to carry out the actions that they'd like to do. But you do. And so when you do a thing that's dedicated or connected to them, you actually give them what's called an ilui, which means they go up. It's a mystical idea, but it means that you give them life. People who don't have children also, people whose children are no longer here. I heard from a big mekubal in Yerushalayim, Kabbalist, who told a friend of mine that no relationship is ever lost. It means that people aren't in this world anymore, but they still are connected to you in exactly the same way that they were before. The only sadness is you can't be with them right now. One of the biggest comforts we have in that situation is that in the Messianic age, so we'll be reconnected with those people. Right? We'll be again one with those people. With that person, people. One has to be very careful. There are unscrupulous forces that are operating in this town right now that try and take people who are bereaved and offer to put them in touch, connect them up with the neshamas of the people whom they've lost. Not that the people are emotionally vulnerable at that time, and many people get involved in that. It's a very clear Torah issur, prohibition. Not only is it a prohibition, it causes tremendous damage to the family, to those who are still alive. It can cause grotesque events to happen in the family, and not only that, but it causes intense pain to the neshama of the person who's not here. We have sources in Tanakh that say clearly that if a person is contacted, if the neshama of a person who's in the next world and has already found a degree of coming to rest there, that's another discussion not for tonight, and you call them up, right? You contact certain parts of the neshama, the outer garments of the neshama which can be connected, contacted, then it causes them tremendous pain and anxiety. It's not a kind thing to do at all. It's exactly anti-Jewish idea. Jewish idea is that they're in that world, we help them. We take responsibility, we live, we do mitzvahs, we add spiritual positivity to the world and they benefit. A non-Jewish idea is that they're in the world, the powerful world, they can help us. So So we'll connect them with us to be our helpers, guides, whatever you want to call it, and they can help us. Exactly the opposite is true from the Jewish point of view. You can hear exactly where that philosophy comes from. It comes from the desire to take away my responsibility and just get me help from outside. That's not the Jewish point of view. The Jewish point of view is that I'm the one who has the responsibility. That's why I'm here. In the next world, there's plenty of time for rest. But when things will be calm and peaceful and beautiful and restful, that's over there. Right now, it's not designed to be that way. Anybody who has difficulty with this idea should try and get hold of the cassette, the tapes of the last, I think it was 2 Monday nights ago, we spoke about ordeals and pain and suffering in life and what is the Jewish idea of that. And the subsequent week we spoke about laughter, how it's possible to have laughter in a world that's as bitter as this. Anybody who has their own personal need for that sort of thing, I would suggest that you get the recordings of those 2 discussions and go through them. So, again, the good news is that there's a place after this, at a dimension after this, which is more real than this is. Remember that comment, because the Rambam is going to speak about it in a very fascinating way, shortly. With that in mind, and everybody has a share there, Jews and non-Jews differently, men and women differently also, everybody has a share. With that in mind, the Rambam lists 13 categories of things that a person can do or fall into that could preclude you from that existence. That means a person could do such negative things that he could cut himself off from his own spiritual source. By the way, the feeling that a person, yes, I understand, that even a person who has no background in Torah and mitzvahs, no understanding of Torah, has a unique intuition and sensitivity that this thing is true. You see, if it weren't true, you wouldn't be upset when someone's no longer in the world. The reason you're upset when someone is no longer with us, the whole death idea upsets us because we know that there's something very special and beautiful about a human being. If the idea that they try to sell you that man's just a monkey, and when you die just a pile of dust and nothing makes any difference, if that were true and you're really, really connected with your personality, you wouldn't be upset at all. On the contrary, you'd be relieved. And while a person's around with you, suffering maybe, or undergoing certain experiences of suffering, there's certain anxiety, even though you know he's only a gorilla, according to them, but nevertheless, it does affect your emotions. But when a person's just a pile of dust and they don't feel anything anymore, so what's the sadness, actually? You don't get too upset and there's one more or less gorilla in the world. Right? So what happens if it just happens to be a gorilla that you happen to know? The truth is, of course, that you don't approach life that way. No matter what they tell you scientifically, that you are just an evolved monkey, but of course your own inner being knows that that's not true. Therefore, you know there's something very real and beautiful about this world, and there's a great loss when an aspect of it's taken away. But it's only because you know that. But once you know that, you should look at the good side. Once your heart tells you, once your own inner being provides all that pain, in those situations, by the same token, it means that there's something that transcends the body. When it's just plain, straightforward, logical. And if it transcends the body, that's where you find the happiness. No one says you rejoice when someone's no longer here. You're sad because you don't have that person right now, because we can't see the other side. But definitely it's a sadness. But the first element of happiness that you should draw out in that sadness is the understanding that that person was real and they haven't disappeared. On the contrary, they've gone into a certain situation that's more real than this is. I'm trying to illustrate that and explain it by looking at the next point in the Rambam. By the way, if you're here for the first time, you're welcome to ask questions on a Sunday night. If I can, I'll answer. Yeah, we have discussed this in the past, but very briefly, did you all hear the question? The idea is this, that it's not, you can't do mitzvahs for them, let's not make a mistake. You can't do a mitzvah on their behalf, that you can't do. They're not, if they don't appoint you to do the mitzvah, you can't take it on yourself to do it. They'll never get the credit of the mitzvah, that's your credit. But what they do get is, they get a credit as follows. There's a spiritual accounting that every neshama goes through in the world, and also every neshama that's not in the world anymore, especially at Rosh Hashanah time, but it happens all the time also. And there's a time that happens when a person dies. As a person transitions into the next world, there's a kind of a judgment. Again, judgment doesn't mean, you know, it doesn't mean a punitive kind of legalistic type judgment. It means an assessment. That's what it means of who you are. And of course, the pain and reward of that is just knowing who you are. Not that they give you a punishment or give you a reward. It just clarifies who you are. Right? You're stripped away of all the illusion that you have here. So you become aware of who you are. That's the pain and that's the reward. And both of them are mixed together. You have tremendous ecstasy about what you achieved and tremendous remorse about what you should have done and didn't do. But that's what it is. Now, that person gets judged. Why do they get judged continually? The question that's always asked is, why does it say that the books of the living and the dead are opened on Rosh Hashanah? It doesn't make any sense. To judge the living, I understand. But what's the sense in judging those who are not here anymore? What have they done during the year that they can? What do they do new this year? You follow the question? I did new things this year. You could judge me for where I'm holding now, as opposed to a year ago. But how could you judge a person who wasn't in the world for a year? There's nothing they can do. The definition of the next world is that they're frozen. They're cursed at the speed which they generated here. So how can you... But the answer is obvious, not difficult to understand. It is that what they're judged for is this. We've discussed this, and I'll just go over it briefly. as follows. A person's judged in the world not only for their direct actions, but you're held accountable for all the ramifications and ripple-out effects of what you do. Is that right? You're held accountable for that. If you say a harsh word to somebody, just one harsh word where you lack control, and you put that person into a mood that's less than it should have been, and that person then speaks to the next person in a way that's not as positive as it should have been, or treats their wife less than ideally that day, or any, right? Even if it's not, sometimes you can provoke a major crisis. A small word can be amplified sometimes in a human system to provoke a major crisis. You don't know it, but a tiny word you may say once in your life might result in a divorce someplace down the line a few days later, or even worse than that, could definitely be, right? Especially with your own wife. But you can this system can amplify effects that ripple out, right, in a very powerful way. But even if it doesn't get amplified, just in the normal course of events, every word you say has a tremendous ripple effect that goes out, and millions and millions and millions of consequences of every glance, every look of every look you give someone, every way you look, just looking at somebody during a conversation, the expression on your face has a ripple effect that will affect millions and millions of things. I mean, it's not telling anything new. You can work it out for yourself. In the real world, which is the world of human achievement. Now, you held accountable for that. You put that out into the world. You take responsibility for that. Right? Of course, more or less, depending on what you knew and what you could have done, what you should have, like we discussed many times before. Now, the truth is that when a person's taken out of the world, but they did actions that are still having consequences. Yeah. And they held accountable for those actions when a person's no longer alive, let's say. But just before they died, there were things they did that are still playing themselves out in the world. Or parents who left children behind. Or anybody who died and left the relationships behind. So the result of those relationships is the people who've been left behind. And they were affected by those relationships. And what they learned from that relationship, and how they grew, or how they allowed themselves to fall, to lack emunah, or to damage themselves spiritually, the consequences are attributable to that relationship. You follow me? And therefore, that person gets judged for the things that are happening now that are attributable to him. The obvious case and the strongest case is a parent. When a parent's no longer in the world, the obvious consequences of the parent's life are the children. That's why this is the strongest connection. It works the other way too, by the way, children for parents also. Parents can do things for children. It's a Jewish custom that if families where a child has been lost, chas v'shalom, in such families, parents often take it very, very seriously to really do something of major impact for the Jewish community so that that person can live on in that way. It's not sentimental. It's a terrible understanding to think sentimentally. We don't mean that at all. We've got nothing sentimental about Judaism. It's a waste of time. It's just emotional nonsense. We're not talking about that. We're talking about doing something that puts spiritual power into the world that substitutes for that person's life, and what happens is the credit attributes itself to that person. They get judged in the next world, tremendous glow of spiritual positivity, because they stimulated that thing in the world. You follow me? So we say Kaddish, by the way. Why we say Kaddish? Kaddish has got nothing to do with the dead. You know that. If you go through the words of Kaddish, it talks only about putting Kedusha into the world, sanctifying Hashem's name, making a more beautiful world. That's all it talks about. Why? Because some of that beauty has been lost when someone dies. So somebody connected to them quickly picks up the spot before it dies and puts that Kedusha. You follow? Are you with me? When a Jew dies, there's a tremendous gap in the world. A human being in general. We're talking Jewishly now. When a Jew dies, there's a spark of Kedusha that left the world tremendously dark. So what happens is somebody who's connected to them in a soul manner, part of the same group of incarnation, whatever it is, so they pick up the spark quickly and put Kedusha back into the world. That's how we say Kaddish. You follow? It's a beautiful idea, not sentimental. It's got nothing to do with the dead. That's the idea. Therefore, the answer to your question is this, that because of that, what we do is we try and do that consciously. When somebody, you asked about somebody who's no longer here, what a person should do is, in appreciation and dedication to that person, because I'm their child or whatever, brothers or whatever, so now I'm going to put into the world something tremendously positive in a Jewish Torah way, right? That's how people try and donate, let's say, money to yeshiva or buy books for a yeshiva or get people to learn Torah, something especially, Mishnah, especially things that are directly Torah related, because Torah has the potential for resurrection of the dead also, not just life in the next world. another dimension. And then what happens is, as the person does that in the world, so the benefit accrues immediately to the person that can save them from tremendous suffering also. Of course, it accrues to you also. You don't miss it like a fire. When you light one candle from another, the first candle doesn't go out. That's the unique quality of fire. You with me? You can light many candles from one candle, the original candle burns just as brightly. So when you do a mitzvah, it could attribute credit and apportion credit to many places. It doesn't take any way of yours. On the contrary, it makes it brighter. Are you with me? And that's the idea. And that's what we do when we want to. You don't have to say the person's name. There is a custom that we write. If you give a book, we write in it, Le'ilu Nishmas, that this book is dedicated in memory of... It's not memory. Again, that's nonsense. That's the English prostitution of the idea. It's not in memory of anybody. It's Le'ilu Nishmas, that person. It means for the elevation of the neshama in the next world. That's what it means. And any time a Jew walks into yeshiva, picks up that book and learns from it, it's a direct credit that accrues to that neshama. That's what it means. Never custom after learning Mishnah to say the person's name, say certain to heal him for them, but that's not the essential feature. Not only that, but even anything a child does positively in the world, and even thinking about the parent, accrues directly to that parent. Right? Especially if it's something that the parent taught. The parent's accountable to a certain extent because the child's here because of them in the first place. That's enough already. But much more when the child carries out the values that the parent actually put into them. Right? Of course, if the child willfully makes himself evil against all the wishes and desires and education of the parent, then that parent doesn't get the discredit for that. You're accountable for your own free will. But inasmuch as you continue, and by the way, this is part of the answer to the question of what it means that the sins of the fathers are visited upon the children and vice versa. If you think about it, you'll see that what we've said already explains that almost fully. Except you'll see that there's some unique features over there. It says that the sins of the fathers are visited upon the children, and for you say that it means if the children carry on the way of the parents. That's what it means. That's exactly what it means. Are visited on the parents to the third and the fourth generation. But mitzvahs of parents are credited to children until the thousandth generation. That's Hashem's proportion of kindness to punishment. You follow? Four generations suffer negativity in this manner, but a thousand generations suffer benefit from positivity. I don't want to go into it more. We've discussed that before. Any other questions on this subject? All right, let's look at the next section in the Rambam. Rambam says this thing. We learned the following thing very briefly. We said that there are 13 categories of Avera that are so bad that they could deny a person his share in the next world. Okay? The first category, we said, is people called Minim, the first of the 13. That has five subcategories, of which we've looked at one or two already. The first one is that is a person who says that there is no creator of the world, and there's no director of the universe. What you'd call in English something like atheism, I suppose, so don't exactly know the appropriate English word. Somebody's a real atheist. We explained all the conditions before for about 2 or 3 weeks already. You have to know what you're doing before you're in this category, not just somebody who's uninformed, and so forth and so on. Let's see the next one. Somebody who says that there is a being who is the creator or the director of the world, but he is two or more. That means he denies the oneness of Hashem. The first person denies the existence of Hashem. That's terrible. That's the major, massive watershed. If you don't accept any spiritual being, so you're not going to have any. Right? It's not a punishment, it's just a consequence, as we explained before. A person who says that there is a spiritual world, but it doesn't all come down to a source of oneness, you follow me? That means there is a world that transcends this, but it's a multiplicity of forces that transcend this. So actually that person is not saying anything at all about them. What's the difference whether you... Are you with me? What's the difference whether you believe in a world that has multiple parts like this one, in which there are energies that are intangible, like electricity and so forth, or whether you believe that there's certain other forces that transcend those forces? You follow? It makes no difference. Not any better. Are you with me? It's probably a lot worse. Are you with me? The fact that somebody believes in a transcendent power that transcends this world, that is the cause and origin and source of this world, but he says that that is not one, so that person isn't saying anything. You follow? It's like he doesn't believe in anything really, so he believes in, so they're forces. That's not much better than believing that there are forces in nature. There are forces in nature. Some of them you can't see either. There's atomic radiation and all kinds of things that you don't see. They're very real. Just because you don't see them doesn't mean you follow. So what difference if you believe that there's a force that transcends that one that you can't see immediately? But there are many of those things. It doesn't bring it down to a source of oneness, which is the ultimate and absolute. So that person is also in this category. And we discussed this to some extent before. I'm not going to go into it now. I want to see the next one. Now listen to the next one. Ha'ayim ashiyei sham riboin echad. Listen carefully now. We haven't seen this before. A person who says that there is a creator of the world, and he is one, aval shehu guf ubal tmuna, but he has a body or some corporeal aspect. Right? He has some diagram or picture or some finite or physical manifestation. Are you with me? you'll realize that, of course, the major Western religion that we are in direct contact with, it's caused us tremendous suffering over the centuries. We have a problem with them, right? They have a problem with most of these. Right? That's how, again, we're not here to run down other people's religions, and we don't look for converts. We believe that if they would do what they claim they should be doing, we would be very happy, right? Let it be said at this point that we'd be very happy if we were doing what we were supposed to be doing too, now, before we point fingers at anybody else. But just, we're talking facts here, okay? Never mind what we're doing wrong right now. Not never mind it, mind it. But they're also doing wrong, and here is the problem, right? Breaking down the divine source into three parts, or however many parts it is. In the East it may be more than that, in the West it may be three. Right? That's what it is. We discussed this in detail also, I'm not going to go into that now. And other branches of Judaism, so-called branches of Judaism, we maybe will go into more fully, also have problems in some of these areas. But this one, let's consider for a moment. Somebody who says that there is a master of the world, and he's one, he is one, this person acknowledges the oneness of Hashem, aval shu guf ubal tmuna, that he has a body, or a, what can I say, the word tmuna means a picture. That means a corporeal element, it's some kind of, how would you translate this? Yes, some kind of, let's say, image or form, okay? That would be the English way to put it. Some kind of form at all. Okay. Now, we have here a very amazing comment of the Rambam. The Rambam was a contemporary of the Rambam's, one of the Rishonim, who attacks the Rambam very viciously, seemingly very, very bitterly. He insults the Rambam, right? The Rambam was, you know, don't want to spend too much time here, but the Rambam was a man on such a transcendent plane that if he walked in here tonight, we probably wouldn't be able to stand to look at him. He was from the Rishonim. He lived, Rambam died in 1135. Right? The Spanish, in fact, celebrated the 850th anniversary of his death some years ago in honor of who he was. And he was from the generation of the Rishonim, which means that we can't begin to conceive what he must have been like spiritually. The Rabbi, who was a contemporary, attacks him as if he was a common, as if he knew nothing at all. You can understand the source of this argument, that it's not tonight's subject, but the Rabbi, at this particular point, some say that the Rabbi did it because the Rambam was so great that he was almost being looked on as a superhuman figure, even in his generation. And therefore, to bring him down to human size, he attacked him in this fashion. Others say, and this is probably the correct understanding, that the Rambam wrote this massive halachic work, which is a definitive, it was the first Shulchan Aruch that was ever written, the first codification of Jewish law ever written was by the Rambam. He didn't quote sources. The Rambam doesn't quote which Gemaras he used in as a source for his halachas, and some of them we don't know what the sources were. And the Rambam felt it was wrong not to quote a source. And therefore he attacks him. I'm not going to go into the discussion now, but listen to what he says. Va'omish yesham ribon echad, somebody who says that there is a master of the world and he's one, just that he has some kind of physical element, Amar Avram, says the Rabbi. Why does the Rambam call such a person an atheist? There are greater and better people than the Rambam who have thought such thoughts. You hear that? Why does the Rambam insult a person who says that Hashem has some kind of form or image? There are people better than the Rambam who have thought that thought, and the Rambam calls them atheists. Now, let's understand. What does the Rambam mean? That there are people, listen, stay with me now, we're about to enter this fascinating area. What does the Rambam mean that there are people better than the Rambam who have considered Hashem to have some kind of image or form? You hear the problem? What's the Rambam mean? Who? Which people better, I'd like to know, which people better than the Rambam have pictured God in a corporeal or physical form? Anybody know? Can you think of anywhere, anybody? Only the Bible. Only the Bible. Only the Torah. Read anywhere in Tanakh and it talks about Hashem's hand and his eye and his beard and his feet. Can talk about that? You've read the Bible? Tanakh? Anybody? Tanakh. The 5 books of Moses and the 24 books of Tanakh. Well, over there, wherever you care to look, it talks about Hashem in very physical terms. You hear the problem? According to what they saw in verses, in the Pesukim, in the Bible, in Tanakh. You hear it? And more than that, what they've seen in Rabbinic, in Agadot, is the mystical tradition. Those which confuse the minds. I'm not going to go into that now. Let's understand the problem. This is going to take us deep into the Kabbalistic zone. Okay? You do not have to be a Kabbalist to understand this, but you'll understand some very fascinating ideas that come out of the Kabbalistic area. If you're here under false pretenses, I'm not offended if you leave. Monday night is supposed to be Kabbalistic night. Sunday night isn't. It's supposed to be practical, so I'm not offended if you're here on the wrong day and you leave. I'm hard to offend. But let's try and make it as clear as we can. We have here a massive problem. I think we've discussed this together maybe a year or two ago, and to some extent, let's try and understand. Here you have the following thing. The Rambam lays down a fundamental principle of Judaism. Listen carefully now. One of the 13 principles of faith. And the Rambam expresses it here as being such a principle of faith that if you don't believe this, you have no share in the world to come. That's very, very heavy. It's not just a sin, not just an avera. It's something that kills your whole spiritual existence. Right? What is that? Believing that there's Hashem, that there's a creator and master of the universe, and believing that he's one, absolute total oneness, but just believing that there's some image that he can be defined or discussed or described in some sort of physical image. Not, and let's be clear about this. The Rambam doesn't only mean a physical image when you consider him to be a man. That's an obviously very, very crude, extreme misrepresentation of the truth. We're not talking about, you follow what I'm getting at, we're not talking about God in the form of a human man. We're not talking about that. Although the Christian religion got it from a very deep Kabbalistic source, which if we get time we'll talk about also. We're not talking about that. We're talking about somebody who pictures Hashem in a transcendent ethereal form, as a transcendent absolute creator of the universe. But they give him some image. For example, a Kabbalistic diagram. Are you familiar with the Kabbalistic diagrams of all the mystical... That's good, you shouldn't be. But there are diagrams in the Kabbalistic world, so I'm told, that show all the forces or energies that come down from the spiritual world, or that represent certain forces in the mystical and spiritual worlds, including worlds that are very close to what we talk about as Hashem, with his name, Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, and they have diagrams. They have diagrams. Now, the Rambam says that anybody who understands, listen carefully, anybody who pictures Hashem in that way, even just a diagram on a piece of paper, never mind having a hand and a foot and so forth, but just anything at all, if you have any picture in your mind, you're guilty of this sin, and you have no share in the world to come. That means if a Jew's davening, you know how serious this is, when you pray, when you're davening, and you say, Baruch Atah Hashem, when you say Hashem's name, if you picture nothing, absolute nothingness, you're okay. But if you picture anything, you've lost your share in the world to come. You hear this? So it seems to be going on here. Anything. That means if you're not totally blank at that moment, you have the problem. It's called Hakshama. Hakshama means giving Geshem, giving physicality to Hashem. What are you going to picture at that moment? Picture a white light. Absolutely not. That's a physical manifestation. That's something in the world. I'm going to allow to do that. That's finite. Hashem isn't a white light. A mystical diagram. What are you going to picture? Whatever you picture is definitely in this category. Can you begin to hear the problem? Yeah. What an insult to Hashem. Nothingness. I said, if you're totally blank, like many of us are most of the time, then you're okay. The trouble is when you try to be blank at this kind of time, not only is your head filled with things that are pictures of Hashem, but usually much worse than that. That's the problem, Ishmael Ezra. I don't know if women have that problem. Men are particularly subject to that. But that's another problem. But we're entering a tiger's country here. You're not allowed to picture anything when you think of Hashem, especially in davening. So how do we handle this area? Now, as if that's not bad enough, the Torah, which is the definition of reality, which is the source where the Rambam got this halacha from, talks about Hashem in very physical terms all over the place. What are you supposed to think when you read that? When you read in the Torah that Hashem did such and such with his head, or it says, Einei Hashem, Meshetetes Bechol Ha'aretz, Hashem's eyes flash around the world all the time. Or Einei Hashem Ba, that Hashem's eyes on the land of Israel all the time. Or that he does this with his hand, but Yad Chazoka took us up with a strong hand and an outstretched arm. And it talks about his beard and his payas and his curls. And if you read in Midrashim, and if you read if you look in what many shuls say on Shabbos, many shuls after Shabbos morning davening, and in Zmirois, many shuls sing. Look over there, you couldn't have a Gazafi, according to the Aleph Beis, the most physical description you could have. Black ringlets that come on it, fall on his forehead, and a beard that rolls down on his. It talks about Hashem in that way. What's going on? What's going on? Are we guilty of this problem? Can you begin to hear the problem? Well, how do we understand this? How do we resolve it? And not only that, what are we supposed to think? When you think about Hashem or when you daven, so what are you supposed to think if you're not allowed to think anything? And you can't think nothing. At the best of times, you can't think what you want to think. Because thought control is the most difficult area that there is. And if you try and think one thing, you definitely won't be able to think of that thing. And if you try not to think about something, for sure that'll be in your mind. So now after you know this, you're really in trouble. Thought today you didn't have a problem, right? You're diamond, so you're diamond. But now you're really finished, right? After you know this. Okay, so we have to solve this problem. It's a very, very difficult and deep area. In the beginning of Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah, the very beginning of this Rambam, he goes into this in detail, and he speaks a little bit what it means about Hashem's attributes that are discussed in the Torah when they are described as being parts of the body. Now let's try and understand this subject fully. Listen carefully. The Rambam there says the following principle. Why is it that since the Rambam there says that it's the obligation of a Jew, he starts off with the halachas that a Jew has to know. One of the first is to believe that Hashem exists, that He's one, that He has no physicality at all. When the Rambam gets to that point, he says, so why does the Torah, he asks this question himself, why does the Torah talk in physical terms about Hashem? And the Rambam answers the following answer. Listen very carefully to this. He says, Dibra Torah Keloshim B'nai Adam. The Torah speaks in human words. That's what he says. The Torah speaks in human words. You hear that answer? What's the Torah supposed to say? Use a word of nothingness, so what would you read? How can you express an absolute infinite oneness, right, that has no corporeal element at all, without saying a corporeal finite word? What are you going to say? If you want to give a Torah, you've got to say something. You follow me? If you want to make a world that is just Hashem and there is nothing else, so then fine. But the world isn't like that. There's you and me, there's up and down, there's black and white, and you want to tell me about Hashem. So you take a piece of parchment, a scroll, and you've got to start telling me. So you've got to say something to me. You follow? Doesn't matter what the words are, even if it's a name. But whatever the word is, it's a finite thing. It's that much ink on that much paper, those many letters, it's something finite. And since we're finite, you can have to speak to us in finite terms. You have to always speak, a conversation always has to go according to the lowest level of abstraction. Is that right? When you speak to a child, you've got to speak to him at a level of his level of abstraction. Start talking to a child in hint. The child is hopeless. You follow? You can't do that. You can only speak in a hint to somebody who knows the fact. Are you with me? If a child understands 1 and 1 is 2, you go tell him A and B is C. You'll think you're joking with him. You don't understand what he's talking about. He's not capable of that level of abstraction. Is that right? Or if you've got a code system with somebody that you speak in code. Like many people do, they got relatives overseas. They ask him how many latkes they can send them and how many. Been known to drive the people on the wiretapping service crazy. But if you speak to somebody who hasn't heard the code, so the boss will think you're crazy. If you can't hint to somebody who doesn't know the underlying system, are you with me? So you take a human being who only understands finite and physical things, what are you going to speak to him? So you speak to him at his level. That's the Rambam's answer. Are you with me? Carefully, stay together. Stay with me. So the Torah, since it has to speak to me and I'm finite, I can only understand things in finite terms, and more than that, I can only understand things in my own terms, since I have a body, I know what a hand and an eye and hair and a beard is. So I can only relate to that kind of world. I can't relate to it. You start talking to me about things that are transcendent that I can't picture in any way. How am I going to relate to them? There's no way I can do anything with that kind of information. It's like speaking a foreign language to me. You with me? So therefore, you speak to me the way I understand. That's the Rambam's answer. Now this answer needs a lot of understanding. Because the following is the problem. What does the Rambam mean by that answer? What do you mean that you can speak to me in a way that I understand? But it's a lie, isn't it? It's a lie. You're lying. And not only that, but he says it's forbidden. Let's try and understand. What's the Rambam answering? Actually, Hashem, there's no such thing as a hand and a foot and an eye. That's what he's saying, right? There's nothing. There's no physical picture at all. Absolutely not. But the Torah says there is because it's speaking to me. So what, because I don't understand, you're allowed to lie to me? What's going on? Do you hear the problem? And not only lie, but say a thing, not only say something that's not true, but say something that's a direct prohibition. I'm not allowed to conceive of anything that's got a face or a hand or a foot or an eye, anything physical, but the Torah is allowed to speak that way? Well, my definition of reality is the way the Torah speaks. Can you hear the problem? So what's the Rambam mean? The Rambam solves the problem. The Torah speaks in human terms, that's why it's allowed to speak that way. It's like taking a child and telling him lies that are forbidden in order to teach him something. You want to teach the child the truth, so you tell him lies in a forbidden way. Well, I can teach him the truth through that. You follow the problem? What does the Rambam mean? So now, I'm going to share with you an idea that comes from the deepest Kabbalistic secrets. It's a very, very most fascinating idea. It takes a lot of thinking, like all Kabbalistic ideas, but it can change a person's life if he understands this. The Rambam says elsewhere, the following idea. And with this, we can try and understand this concept. And also, let's try and leave a little bit of time for the practical aspect, what a person is supposed to picture when they say words like Hashem's name or when they don't. The Rambam says the following amazing, amazing principle. He says that there are two levels of reality, physical and spiritual. That means, when you look at a physical object, there is a physical object that you see, but there's a spiritual being that invests that physical object, which keeps it in existence. For example, a human being. That's the easiest example always to understand. A human being is a piece of meat, piece of steak. That's what a person is, no different from a monkey. But inside, there's something that's human. A person who's alive and a person who's not alive, it's the same piece of meat, but there's an enormous difference. You follow me? There's something inside that's ethereal. You can't see it, you can't picture it, you can't grasp it, but it's attached to the body in some way. That is the transcendent force that's inside a human. The Rambam, and this is the Kabbalists say all over, every physical object, even a physical object, inanimate object in the world, has a physical reality, but it has a spiritual, what's called a Koyach Nivdal. Koyach Nivdal means a transcendent force. A root force, a transcendent force. That force is the existence, the neshama of this thing. If this table, you follow me, if the Koyach Nivdal of this table disappeared, for sure the table wouldn't be here. You follow? It certainly wouldn't be possible for the concrete manifestation of the thing to be here if that root force wasn't here. Now, that's fact one. Fact two is that the root force also has a root force. Because you can look at the system of reality at any level on the scale. We're just familiar with it at this level, the finite physical world, and one level up, we just begin to have something to do with, like a human neshama. But the neshama also has a neshama. And that neshama also has a neshama. And the relationship between the two of them is in the same proportion. If you think my body and my neshama are very different, you should hear, right? Wait till you get an understanding one day, right, when we're able to, of what my neshama is compared to my neshama. Neshama of my neshama. You follow me? And so it goes. And of course, the ultimate neshama of the neshama of the neshama ad infinitum is Hashem. Okay? That's the system. Now, stay with me. But we don't discuss the whole system. We look at it, we freeze it anywhere. Take any world, any spiritual world. For argument's sake, take this one. It's easiest. And just look at the two levels, what are called male and female. You have the physical existence that gives shape and life and reality to the thing. And above it, you have the Koyach Nivdal, the spiritual force that is the root of this thing. Now, there's much to say about this, but the one thing that the Rambam points out that we have to understand this evening is this. He says that the spiritual force is more real than the physical one. You hear that? It's more real. Now, let's get this clear. That's the answer to our problem. That's the answer. Now, let's understand what it means. You didn't hear the answer yet? Let's try and discuss it. The problem here is we've got to get an idea out of our heads, okay? We don't have to put anything in, we just have to get an idea out. If we get something that we're used to out, it'll all be clear. We are used to thinking about physical reality as real. That's the way we're taught to think. What I can see and taste and touch and feel, that's real. What transcends that spiritually, well, maybe take it or leave it. You know, if you believe, maybe yes, I don't, so don't bother me. You know, I don't experience it directly, so I don't have anything to do with it. Which obviously is foolish. Ultimate foolishness, like a person denying electricity. One day when he sticks his fingers in the plug, so he'll change his mind about that thing that he couldn't relate to before. Just because you don't experience it now, right? We're all going to do that sometime. You're eventually going to get stuck into the plug. You know, you get hooked up to the voltage. And then you'll feel the force. But until then, that's honest foolishness to deny something that you just don't experience directly, obviously. So let's understand that there could be, let's take it for granted right now, that there is a world of transcendent forces. The thing to understand is that they're more real than this. The only thing is we relate to this world as real because we've got the sense organs. Do you follow how egocentric we are? It's pathetic. Just because it's like a baby who can only relate to like a little circle of reality around him, so he denies there's anything outside of it. Why? Because he can't experience it, so he denies it exists. We're also babies in that way. We just have a point of contact with reality to a certain extent, so we just deny that there's anything beyond that. Stupid, absolute foolishness. Right? Especially as life teaches you that there's an ever-expanding worlds of reality that you can get in touch with. A baby is amazed to discover when he becomes a child what the world really is. And a child when he becomes old is amazed to discover that there's depth and depth and depth. So why do you think it stops there? Yeah. It's a very, very frozen and narrow-minded attitude to think, well, okay, now I've really got the knowledge. And now that I'm mature and I've grown to this age and stuff, and so I've got even a university degree, so now I really know about reality. That's pure foolishness. But the important idea we have to get out of our heads is this, that we see that what we can experience is real. The next other level of reality we see as shaky. Maybe yes, maybe no. The Jewish idea is like this. Listen carefully. The physical level of anything is always much less real. The more finite, again, I'm using that word in a certain way. It is real, what can I tell you? The physical world is real. It can hurt you badly. You have to take great care about the physical world. I'm not saying it's not real. But in spiritual terms, I don't know what other word to use in English. In spiritual terms, it's less real than the spiritual force. You follow me? The only way is to give an example. What's more real about a person, his body or his neshama? No question that the neshama is what really counts. In many ways to show it. First of all, you can damage the body, it doesn't change who you are. You follow me? Imagine you chopped away parts of a person's body more and more and more. Imagine he could still stay alive. It wouldn't change his neshama. Do you follow? The essential person is the essential person. The body is obviously just a vehicle. Obviously. And anybody with any sense knows that when you relate to a human being, what you're interested in is the person inside. You aren't interested in the piece of meat that carries them around. Although this generation is, of course. This generation is only interested in superficiality. So that's all they're interested in. The relationship never goes deeper than that. But of course, that's not. Anybody with any sense, sensitivity, knows that what you're interested in is the person inside. That's what you're trying to discover all the time. Are you with me? Obviously, that's what's more real in human terms. So the spiritual concept is, the physical reality is a certain thing, but it's only a vessel, it's an empty vessel, just a vehicle, that's all. It just carries you around. Don't make a mistake, it's very important. But it's nothing compared to the power and the glow of the spiritual level that's inside it, that animates it, that gives it existence. Now that level has a level that's powerful compared to it in the same way. And so it goes. Now, what does this mean? So let's understand. Now we come to the most amazing idea. So what do we have like? We have like this. We have a physical reality, we have a spiritual. The spiritual reality is more real. So now, let's understand. I once heard this from a man who never admits to any mystical knowledge, but he's one of the most, well, very, very great men. Happened to be present when he was discussing the subject, and he put it in this fascinating way. It's clear, it's absolutely clear. The mystics all talk this way, but it's beautifully put. Listen carefully. The Rambam says that the Torah talks about a hand, Hashem's hand. So, when the Torah talks about Hashem's hand, the problem is that, why do we get it wrong? Why do we have this problem? Why do we have this problem that Hashem doesn't have a hand, right? We know He doesn't have a hand. He doesn't have anything physical. And the Torah talks about Hashem's hand, and we can't handle that idea, and the Rambam says it's forbidden. You know why? Because our thinking's crooked. Our thinking's backward. The truth is, you see, we think this is a real hand. We think this is a real hand. And when the Torah talks about Hashem's hand, it's just talking in a borrowed language. It means it's an analogy. You follow? That's what people understand. You follow? When the Torah talks about Hashem's hand, obviously it can't be in Hashem's hand. It can't be in a hand. Because we know that you're not allowed to think of a thing like that. Oh, it's true. So it means the Torah is talking in human terms. It means it's using borrowed language. It's an analogy. It's a marshal. Like a child can't understand what you mean in spiritual. So you give him a practical, tangible example. You don't mean the tangible thing, but it's good enough for him to get a grasp and understanding. That's why you always give a person an example or an analogy. So the Torah is just using an analogy. You follow? That's how people understand that drama, but it's horribly wrong. Because it means this. It means this is a real hand. Hashem's hand is just an analogy that the Torah is using. And if you think that pathway, you'll get all the problems that we started with. Say the mystics the following thing. Hashem's hand is a real hand. This is a marshal. This is an analogy. You hear that? Listen carefully. When the Torah talks about Hashem's hand, talking about a real hand, that Hashem does have. What we see in the physical world is just an analogy to enable you to begin. You're just a baby. You can't understand the real thing said in abstract terms. So I'll give you a physical manifestation of the thing that you can understand. And I expect you to grow up one day and take that understanding. You follow me? Do you understand what a hand is? What a hand is, what a hand can do? And why there are five elements to it, and why there are 10 with right and left together, and why they're mirror image of each other. You understand what that means, and what it does in the world, and what it can produce, and what it's an extension of your being, and what you do with your hands. You begin to understand what the Torah means when it talks about Hashem's hand, which is a real hand. Then you begin to get some idea about power, and about action, about what gets done in the world, and about something real. But you would never understand that unless you saw a crude analogy of the thing. Stay with me. Are you with me at all? Anybody? Imagine the Torah came along and you didn't have hands, right? You never saw a hand before. And the Torah starts talking about Hashem's hand. Leave you cold. What are you supposed to do about that? How can I understand? So Hashem says, you know what I'll do? I'll build you the same way as me. I'll build you at all. Just an analogy of the real thing. Are you with me? So now you can begin to appreciate, like a child who starts to work with a model of the real thing, because now when you see the real thing one day, you'll understand it. Are you able to picture what that real thing? Are you with me? Let me give you a very crude, analogy. It's like this. The mystics say, listen to this, it's the most amazing thing. They say that the world is like a projection of the spiritual world. It means like Hashem, in the spiritual world, there are certain realities. he projects those down into a medium that has matter. And the matter takes shape according to that projected reality. So now in physical, tangible matter, you can see examples of the way the thing is up there where there isn't any matter. Are you with me? No, don't blame you. Give you a practical example. I'll give you an example like this. A person goes to see a projection of a movie on a wall, on a screen. Huh? So what happens is this. What you see is something that looks like it's alive and moving. You can relate it, you can study it, you can see it, see all the details, fantastic, color, details, everything. Actually, what you're watching is a complete illusion. It's a total illusion. What you're watching is some light on a wall. What is it? It's just light that's shining through a plastic film on which there's certain pictures and colors. That's tangible. That plastic thing is tangible. What you're seeing is just a reflection. Actually, the plastic film is also not real. It's also just a picture of something that took place way distant in time and place. Somebody took a picture of people actually doing those things. You follow? And so it means that when you sit and watch something being projected in front of you, actually you couldn't be further from the truth. You're miles away from the event in time and space. All you're watching is a very, very faint and distant representation of the thing. Are you with me? You follow? But the point to remember is, but it's good enough, because that thing will think about the reality. One day when you meet the person whom you studied on the film, you'll recognize them. Or when you go to the place, the scenery of which you're busy studying over here, you'll recognize it. It'll be real to you. You follow me? Even though you didn't get near it now. That's the physical world. One day when you get into Hashem's world, when you're exposed to the spiritual reality, it'll be familiar to you. Because you've seen a crude and coarse, you've seen it projected into physical finite tissue over here. This is very miserable stuff. Very miserable stuff here. Subject to disintegration. It fails. It's finite. It lasts only a few years. It disintegrates. It rots like a monkey's. It's very, very crude stuff. Very coarse and crude physical tissue, but just good enough. Do you follow me? It's no more real than the light that's dancing on the screen is real. Complete illusion compared to the reality, but it's perfect representation of the reality. Are you with me? We'll get there. We'll get there. We'll get there. Whoa, 1 second. Let me just finish the idea and then we'll leave time for questions. So, it's like this. The mystics don't put it that way. They weren't talking in the days when there were movies, and also they didn't want to use something of such impure nature, to give you an example. Just in our smashed generation, we have to... Now, that's a medium that could have been used to teach this spiritual value that's used to actually make animals out of people. That's why you shouldn't go to movies. But that's another subject. But the mystics talk about a stamp and that which is stamped. That's how they talk about chetam v'nechtam, a stamp. You follow me? They talk about a stamp like a... Yes, like a seal, you know, an embossed stamp that imprints an image in soft clay or seal. What happens then is when the thing is removed, you have a perfect, perfect manifestation of the thing there. You couldn't be further from the truth. You couldn't be further from the thing. If you think you're looking at the stamp, you're wrong. That thing might not exist anymore. It might be hundreds of miles away. But what you're seeing is an exact replica of what that thing was. The mystics point out that what's left is right and right is left, and what's up is sunk and what's sunk is up. That's another subject. Not going into that now. But read that as it may. And by the way, that's why the eye sees upside down, and that's why the nerves cross over from the brain. I'm not going to go into that now. Let's do. But the point is, and this stamp, of course, when it hardens, you can make a stamp in another material from that. And you can take that one, and you can make hundreds of stamps, one from the next. Do you follow? And in the end, you'd have an exact representation of what the first one looked like. And that's what this world is. It's a stamp of a stamp of a stamp of a stamp. You follow? Miles away. You couldn't be further from reality. If you think you can look at a tree and see Hashem, you couldn't be more wrong. No matter how much you look at a tree, you're going to see a tree. But if you understand that what you're seeing is a physical stamp of a certain angelic manifestation that stamped it out, and he himself was formed by a higher force, and so forth and so on, that's the way you're looking at the world. The purpose of it all, of course, is so that you can have what to relate to. The deep purpose of it is that Hashem... Listen carefully, is that Hashem never expects you to do something that you can't tangibly relate to. That's why he always, listen carefully, he always gives you a tangible example of anything he wants you to do or understand, so that you can relate to the thing. Hashem comes and he says to you, I want you to understand the next world. It's a time where there's no action, there's only rest. How would you picture such a thing? No way. So he gives you Shabbos. Shabbos. You live through a day where you experience what it is to be, to come to rest, not to prepare anything, and you actually get a 1 in 60th taste of the next world. He wants you to understand what death is, he gives you a sleep experience. Prophecy gives you a dream.
anything that you need to experience in the world. He gives you a tangible example, right? Even the mist, even in halakha, it says that even unkosher things, every single forbidden pleasure in the world, there's a kosher version of that pleasure, so you can understand and relate to the thing. One reason. For example, milk and meat. How can a person taste milk and meat together? That person wants to taste that. The udder of a cow. Do you know that? The udder of a cow, if prepared correctly, is kosher, and has a taste of milk and meat together, of course. Yes. There's nothing in the world, forbidden or real, whatever, that, which means, but the basis of the idea is that in order to relate to something, since I'm finite, you've got to give me a finite example. You follow me? All I've got is a screen in front of my eyes. You want me to understand something that's real? All I can see is a screen, two-dimensional screen. Project the light on the screen that's shone through a picture that you took of the thing. I understand what you mean. You don't have to take me there. You follow? It's such a perfect representation. You don't have to take me there. And I'll understand, and I'll know. One day when I get there, I'll recognize the place. But I've got enough to work with now. You follow me? You can't take me there, because there there'd be nothing for me to do. In Hashem's hand, the hand is the same as the foot. Obviously, it's all oneness. His hand and his eye and his beard and his feet, it's all the same thing up there. He doesn't have a hand that's different from his foot. How can you take me there? I wouldn't see anything. In fact, I wouldn't be there if you took me there. I'd be part of that. So to have me here, what you've got to do is separate it all out into finite examples. Are you with me at all? You're not going to come next week, right? And therefore, you give me a tangible experience of the thing. And that's what the Rambam means. Dibra Torah Gloshon Be'arom. The Torah speaks in human terms. Not that the Torah talks about things that are real, like your hand. So you can understand about a moshel, that Hashem's hand is a moshel. Chas v'shalom. Exactly the opposite. The Torah says it like it is. That's Hashem's hand. That's exactly what it is. Yours is just a crude analogy so you can begin to understand something real. Yours is finite and separate from your foot and from your eye and from your beard and so forth. You follow me? Huh? But you've got a tangible example. Now you can start thinking about the world. Okay? And there's different levels. I don't want to go into the followers of the Ramchal said. The Ramchal's followers used to say that when it talks about Hashem's hand, it means his hanhaga, for example. A hand is something that does. So when the Torah talks about Hashem's hand, it means that which he does in the world. His eyes mean the fact that he's conscious and sentient, he sees things. It doesn't mean an organ or a thing. It means a way of describing what's called a hanhoga, a function, a pa'ula. But the other mystics say that that's not good enough because although it's true, it means that also. But if it says Hashem's hand, it means Hashem's hand. There has to be such a thing. The Torah is the definition of truth. It's not an analogy or a crude way of saying things. The Torah is exactly the essence of truth. If the Torah says Hashem has a hand, boy, that's 100% true. Yours is a crude way of beginning to... Are you with me? Now, let's just think about this for a second. I'm just going to tell you one more idea and we'll leave it at that, unless you have questions. We come out from this with a most amazing principle. And I heard this from the same source. He said the following thing. Listen carefully. It comes out, in Torah, the technique we use is when you hear a principle, you must apply it as broadly as possible. Okay? Never take a principle to be limited. If an idea is true in Torah, it will work across the board in every possible circumstance. There will never be exceptions. If it's an essential idea. That's the nature of the truth. Therefore, what we've learned tonight, we can apply absolutely everywhere. Let's try. It would come out from what we're saying now. I'm just going to show you one or two applications of this. It would come out from what we're saying now that every single thing that you experience in the world is an unreal experience to teach you about reality. Is that right? Is that right? Let's say you laugh. Who was here when we discussed laughter? We discussed laughter a couple of weeks ago. A person laughs. It's a crazy response. It's crazy to laugh. It's not. You laugh at things that aren't funny at all. Is that right? Usually you laugh the worst at things that aren't funny at all. An embarrassing thing happens to somebody or something. You know, you just can't hide. Right? Why? To teach you something about the spiritual world. You want to know what it is? Get the discussion where we had that discussion to find out what it is. A person cries, and every detail that happens in the physical world teaches you about reality when a person cries. You know what the mystics say? First of all, you can't see properly when you cry. Secondly, water comes out of your eyes, right? And you can't speak at the time. That's exactly what crying is in the spiritual world. Because, it's a long discussion, just wanted to give you an example, that in the spiritual world, crying means the response to confusion. That's what it says. When you can't see the way anymore, the response is called crying. In the spiritual world, when the pathway is clear, you have happiness. When the pathway is not clear, you have what's called crying. Where there's a mixture of possibilities. That's why tears, isn't that amazing? Tears in Hebrew, tears dim'ah. Dema in Hebrew means a mixture of things. Bechi, which means crying, Mevucha in Hebrew means a confusion of roads, where you're lost on the path. You follow them? The word actually means the thing. Water, why does water come out of the eyes? Water is the mystical medium of dissolving of shame. That means where the definition starts to get dissolved into an unformed stage, that's what water is. That's why there's water involved in crying. Do you follow? I mean, every human experience, no matter what it is, intimate experiences, every detail, every hair on your head, every emotion, every thought, every ray of light, every grain of dust, every single thing in the world, is just a crude and physical, beautiful illustration of a spiritual idea, so that you can begin to have some idea of what it is you're supposed to have. But they can't show you that thing because you wouldn't be in a body, you wouldn't be in a physical world. And you're supposed to be here to get the job done. So they project into your crude screen. Are you with me? Everything in the world is like that. Now that's true. I'll just share with you one last idea. This man, I heard him say this at his grandson's breast, and Miller from Gateshead, he explained it this way. He said, if that's true, that's a fantastic question. You should be jumping up and down asking me this question already. But a great Torah mind thought of the following question. If everything in the world is an unreal experience to teach you about reality, what's a dream? What's a dream? Because a dream is an experience of unreality. One second. If everything in the world is let's call it an unreal experience. Right? To teach me something about reality, we said that the higher world, the spiritual world, is more real. So then what's a dream? A dream is an experience of exactly the opposite. A dream is an experience of unreality. When I dream, I go through experience where I think I'm experiencing something real. Is that right? I can be agonized in a dream, absolutely terrorized, or ecstatic in a physiological responses in a dream. And I'm experiencing it. They're absolutely, totally real. And in one instant I wake up and suddenly, absolutely, blindingly, clearly, I know that that was a dream and this is real. Don't ask me how, but I know. Now, what's that supposed to teach me? You follow? If everything in the world is unreal, to teach me about reality, why does Hashem create? Now, if you think that the reason you dream is because a few million years of gorillas accidentally evolved some neurological pathways in their brain that happened to get them to dream because it had some kind of survival thing, you really need your head read. Okay, that isn't why you dream. Why you dream is a very, very, very powerful spiritual reality. Very powerful spiritual reality. It's an experience of prophecy. What's left of prophecy in the world, the 60th of prophecy. Very, very powerful experience. I remember one morning in Israel, my wife and I woke up. We both had the same dream exactly. We both knew what it meant. It was a terrible thing. And before we could do anything about it, the thing had happened. During the night, exactly the time, we both had a dream. I'm not going to tell you what it is, because for sure you'll dream it. If you know about these things, you dream them. We knew exactly what that thing meant, and we went to get three men to come to the house to make a tavas acholim. It's the thing you can do if you have a bad dream. That can improve it. But before we could sit down, the thing had happened. I mean, we knew it. Anyway, remarkable. Two people should have the same dream exactly. Nothing that we spoke about, nothing connected to anything. There's a whole thing you have to know about dreams. If you dream a thing in the first third of the night, it's not significant. It depends. You have the same dream three times. If it's something you thought about before you went to sleep, it's not significant. It has to be something that's completely new. You have to know. There's a whole pericon that goes on about dreams. Maybe we'll study it sometime. But the point is, dreams are an amazing thing. Now, but one of the features of a dream is the fact that it's unreal. And you know what it says in the mystical writings? That every dream, no matter how real, no matter how incredibly prophetic, every single dream always has some nonsense in it. You know that? No matter how high it is and how clear and how prophetic, and even a dream recorded in Torah, every dream has at least something that's nonsense. Why? Why? Why do they say that? Because a dream is an experience of unreality. That's what it's meant to be, even though it may be prophetic. But it always has something unreal. What's unreal about it? You're not actually living that experience. And so even in what you're dreaming, there'll be something that's unreal. Are you with me? So it's an experience of unreal. Now what does that teach you? What does that teach you about the world? What does that teach you about reality? For heaven's sake, what does something of unreality teach me about reality? You hear the problem? So the answer is as follows. Obvious with what we said this evening, exactly the same. There are no exceptions in the spiritual world. Everything has to fit the rules perfectly and exactly, and so does this. You know what a dream teaches you? One of the most important things that there are, that there could ever be in the world. That experience of unreality teaches you about reality in a more potent way than anything else could. Let me give you an example. Let's say you come to a person and you say to him, you know what, my friend? Think this world is real? Think this world is all there is? Tangible, physical, you experience it now, you think you're going to be here forever? Think this world is real? Never experienced anything else, and therefore you think this is what's real? I've got news for you. One day, you're going to suddenly, unexpectedly, suddenly, go through a transition. You're going to enter another world where you'll suddenly realize what's reality. You'll suddenly realize that that world is real, and this world's completely unreal. This world disappears like a puff of smoke. You'll suddenly realize that all those years you spent here, just gone like nothing. A memory, that's all they'll be. And you'll suddenly understand what reality is. Now, if anybody with his feet on the ground, level-headed, would say to you, just do me a favor. Keep your spiritual stories for yourself. I know what I know. I know what I experience. What I see is what you get. And I said, except somebody who's had a dream. Because anybody who's ever had a dream could never say that to you. Think about it. Anybody who's ever had a dream in which he had an experience of reality that was so total he was about to die or about to burst with ecstasy. And at that moment, he woke up and he suddenly became completely aware that that was a dream and this is real. Which, by the way, is incredible. Anybody who does it and doesn't worry, anybody who wakes up from a dream and is absolutely relieved and wipes his brow and goes to sleep and doesn't worry for a moment, 1 second, just 1 minute over here, what's going on here? How do I know that this... No, Hashem built it that way. You know, while you're dreaming, you think it's real. Absolutely think it's real. But when you wake up, you know that was a dream and this is real. So you've actually experienced that in your flesh. You follow? You've actually, in your flesh, experienced the transition from unreality to reality. How can you ever deny after that? You've been given a tangible example of that transition. Do you follow me? You've actually lived it. Everybody's done it. You'd have to be the biggest idiot in the world to deny when somebody comes to you and says that what you're going through now is only one form of reality. There's going to be a transition into another form. How could you be so crude to deny a thing that you've actually been given an example of, just like the rest of the world? And that's what a dream comes. A dream, amazing. A dream, which is the biggest experience of unreality in the world, comes to teach you about the biggest reality in the world, which is the transition from this to the next. That's what it's for. That's what it's for. You follow me? Hear what those idiots have done out there to tell you that a few million years of neurobiological evolution, you know, follow, you wouldn't have been a successful gorilla now if you hadn't had a few years of gorilla's dreams. So that's why it's needed. Obviously, the child whether such a person ever going to wake up. Are there any questions about what we said? Yeah. Only relative to the next. Yes, definitely. The question was, if this world is only an unreal version of what's real, so then it means the Torah also is unreal. Absolutely. The mystical writings say, you know what they say? The Torah that we have in this world is noivlois kochma shomala. Noivlois means the dead leaves that fall off the tree, that's all. The Torah we have here is nothing. It's just the faintest drippings from the spiritual world. It's only the Torah of the real world translated into what a human being could absorb. But what Hashem has in his world, it says, nothing like the Torah we have here. It's the source of reality of the Torah. Of course, it corresponds exactly. But it's like, if you want a faint analogy, the difference between the light you see on a screen and the actual reality out there. Of course it is. It's only a projection. Definitely. Definitely. After all, it's only a few words on a piece of paper. But it's an exact projection. Let me just spend... I don't want to keep you. I'll keep you for 2 more minutes, just because we said we would, to tell you what you're supposed to think when you think about Hashem, okay? In terms of this Rambam, that you're not allowed to think anything. So very briefly, I'm not going to go into philosophy. I'm just going to summarize the halacha for you. This is halacha that comes from the mystical sources. If a person is not allowed to conceive of Hashem as having anything finite or physical, which we're still back to that problem over here, with all of tonight's explanation, he's still not allowed to think about Hashem. You follow me? We're still back to that problem. Now we know, after what we've studied together, that Hashem's hand is a real hand. But he's still not allowed to picture a hand. Chas v'shalom. He's still not allowed to picture a human hand. What you're picturing is the analogy. Hashem's hand is a real hand, but you can't picture that. The exact reason you've been giving the analogy is because you can't picture the real thing. So if you have a picture of a hand in your head, of course you're doing what's forbidden. That problem we haven't solved. You follow me? All we did was lay down the background in the spiritual wisdom. But you, so what are you supposed to think? So in the mystical writings it says the following thing, but this is halacha, you have to know this, okay? When you say Hashem's name, what are you allowed to think? Not what you're allowed to think, what are you allowed to picture? Be very careful, there's 2 issues here. You are supposed to think something that the name means, and you are also going to picture something in your mind. There's 2 separate things, is that correct? Everything that you do in your mind is an understanding of the thing, but you also have a picture of the thing. You can't function without an image. Are you with me? You're very close to it in meditation. You can make yourself relative. But most things that you think about as a specific thing, you have an image of the thing, and then you have the meaning of the thing. What's the meaning of Hashem's name, and what's the image that you're allowed to have? So very briefly, the meaning of Hashem's name is clear. When you say Baruch Atah Hashem, and you say Adoi, that name, right? Aleph Dalet Nun Yud, Adnus, Shem Adnus. Are you with me? That name, you don't... course, what's printed in the Siddur is not that name, right? What's printed is Yud Kei Vav Kei. Most Siddurim actually just print an abbreviation. They print the Dalet with a dash or Yud Yud. And I actually studied, I was privileged to learn with a mystic who told me he never uses any Siddur other than ones that actually print Hashem's name out in full. Because while you are saying Aleph Dalet Nun Yud Adoy, that name, you're supposed to think Yud Kei Vav Kei. Right? While you say with your mouth the one name, you're supposed to think the other name. I'm not going to go into the meaning of that, but very briefly, it's just because that name can never be put into the world. So we put into the world the one that can be said in the world. But in a mind which is transcended, we hold the one that can't. You follow? That's what we do. We connect the mystical and spiritual world that way. This Art Scroll Siddur, by the way, prints out Hashem's name in full without the vowels to indicate that you shouldn't pronounce it. But that's what you should look at while you're saying the other one. Sfardi Siddurim, by the way, anyone who's done this on Sfardi, if you look at the Sfardi Siddur, they have Yud Kei Vav Kei and intertwined in the letters Aleph Dalet Nun Yud. So that you can say those letters while you look at the other ones. Or in some Siddurim they have Yud Kei Vav Kei, and the last Hay is very long, and underneath the Hay they have small Aleph Dalet Nun Yud. So that you can actually say that name of Hashem, read it, while you actually see the name that we're not allowed to say. Are you with me? Now, slowly. So like this. The meaning of the name Yud Kei Vav Kei, which is what you're thinking, even though you're not saying it, is was, is, and will be. Okay? That's it. That's what you're supposed to think. Means was, is, and will be. That's what it is. That's the meaning. Anyone asks you, what does the name of Hashem mean? I mean, in practical pshat that you can actually explain in words, that means existence. Was, is, and will be. I'm not saying Hashem is synonymous with existence. He's the cause of existence. But the name means was, it. But what do you picture? That's what we're discussing this evening. When you say Baruch Ata Hashem, what picture is allowed to come into your mind? If you picture any picture, says the Rambam, you're guilty. You just transformed the mitzvah of davening into one of the most serious prohibitions in the Torah that a person loses his share in the next world for. Brother, you don't want to be caught in that. You don't want to get that wrong. So what do you picture? So the mystical sources say three things are allowed. Listen carefully and we'll finish with this. There are only three things that you may picture, and one of them is no longer allowed in our generation. One thing, I'll just deal with it because to say that it's not allowed anymore, is what's called kavonos. Kavonos means mystical combinations and permutations of Hashem's name, each of which has a specific spiritual meaning. Are you with me? Combinations of letters in certain ways that in this particular bracha, at this particular time and place, that particular permutation or combination has a certain spiritual force, and they are enormously powerful. They bring down energies to the world exactly to the target that you want. But you've got to know what you're doing. If you get it wrong, it can be a terrible mess. And we're no longer powerful enough. Believe me, if today you can say Shmon Esrei, you can say the first bracha without your mind wandering off the simple meaning of the words, you're superhuman. Okay? If you can get that right, if you finish ever a Shmona Esrei, take three steps back and your mind is still on the davening, so you're one of the Gedolei Hador these days. You're one of the greatest minds on earth. Yeah? Because most of us can't concentrate on the same thing for 30 seconds in a row. That's the unfortunate truth. But there were people at a level, until the last generation, the powerful concentration was so great that they could work out these things. If you look in the Sfardi, if you look in the Siddur HaRashash, which is one of the great Kabbalistic Siddurim, there you'll see that the first word of the Shmona Esrei is just one word on the page, that's all. The word's Baruch, and there's nothing else on the page, just one word. And around it are all the mystical permutations and combinations of all the kavanas of that word. And people who daven like that, I once heard somebody used to go to a kol in Yerushalayim where they daven that way. The Shliach Tzibur would get up after everybody finishes Shmona Esrei. The chazan gets up, and he says, he starts off and he says the word Baruch, and there's silence for 5 minutes, while everybody works through the Tzirufim. You follow? Takes a long time to daven Shmona Esrei over there. When Rav Shaul Dweck was a great Mechaben of the last generation, when he used to get to the bracha of a Sechazer Neinein, he used to pass out from power. You had to wait till he came around. That's very, very, very powerful stuff. Now, we are not allowed to do that anymore, right? And as you can imagine, I don't have to explain to you why. If you start going into kavanas, you know where you're going to end up. And therefore, we don't do that anymore. That's the one thing. So it is a possible idea, we don't do it. Second thing that's possible to picture is absolute. The Gaon of Vilna, Reb Chaim Volozhin said that his great teacher, the Gaon of Vilna, used to daven in that way. Even though he certainly was capable of using the kavanas, he used to daven in that way. Ketinoik amischata lifna abib, like a baby in front of his father just saying, Abba, without knowing what it means. Just tata, daddy, without knowing what it means at all. No picture at all. Say Hashem's name, to think of him as, just like you would say your father, without knowing at all, any picture, nothing at all, totally blank. If you can do that. The difficulty with that is many people find it. It's allowed. That means you say Baruch Ata. You say Adoy. You say that word. Your mind is thinking the Yud Kei Vav Kei, that name, and you are picture, and it means was, is, and will be, and you are picturing absolute nothingness. In case you thought davening was easy, in case you thought davening was just spitting out a few words the same as you did yesterday, in case you think it's not enough either, so you got it wrong. It's the greatest, most intense meditation that it could be. It's the greatest mind training, and it's the greatest way to change your personality. That's what it is. The third way, and I personally recommend this in my humble opinion, I think people should do this because it's by far the easiest, it's definitely allowed, it's a very, very hard thing to do, especially if you find difficulty, if you try and clear your mind and think of a blank as nothingness, and you have trouble with it, and you then come to forbidden things, and the tendency to think of terrible things, therefore you should opt for the third option, and it's as follows. You should say, Baruch Atah Hashem, you say Aleph Dal, you say Adoy thing, and you picture with the mind, Yud Kei Vav Kei. That's what you picture. Black on white. You're allowed to do that. Follow me? You picture the word. And the halacha is that when you're davening Shmoneh Esrei, your eyes must either be closed or looking in the Siddur. You're not allowed to look around. So therefore, if your eyes are in the Siddur, you must choose a Siddur. I would recommend that you choose a Siddur where it actually prints out the Yud Kei Vav Kei. It doesn't have an abbreviation like Yud Yud. So you can actually see that word while you say the other word. So that you actually are looking at black and white. You won't go wrong. Eyes will not, your mind will not wander. Or if you prefer to close your eyes while you're davening, you know it by heart, then you should picture a black on white Yud Kei Vav Kei. Don't get me wrong, you're not picturing ink on paper. You're not reducing Hashem to some ink on paper. That's not what we mean. Are you with me? But the form of the letters, Yud Kei Vav Kei, is a name that He has given us. Although it is only a finite representation of some ink on paper, but Hashem Himself has chosen to represent Himself in the world by that name. And a name is the most powerful aspect of essence. And if you call a name, the person responds. It goes to the essence of the person and it evokes a response. And Hashem has given us that name. And He chose to write it that way, and therefore you know how to picture that. Are you with me? So therefore, if you have trouble, some people find it easier to think nothing at all. They say, Hashem, they have like a baby in front of his father. Those who find it easier or find that very difficult, they should say, Baruch Atah Hashem, Aleph Talet Nun Yud. Thinking the word Yud Kei Vav Kei, actually seeing the shape of the letters in front of them, will prevent your mind from wandering, and it's one of the deepest things that a person can do.